This is Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the music and the artists behind the 2016 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. I'm Chris Moore. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. So many things are happening at the Aspen Music Festival this week that we have no less than four interviews to go through. That includes violinist Adele Anthony and pianist Jeremy Dank, who has two concerts coming up on the 28th and the 30th, the Aspen Contemporary Ensemble with a Saturday concert and many more, and then the American Brass Quintet on Wednesday. Let's start with the American Brass Quintet. Here's Kevin Cobb. You have a lot of recordings out. There's a large discography. And you play music that goes as early back at least to the Renaissance. And you also do premieres. And you have no less than two world premieres that we are hearing. Tell us about these two premieres. And what are they doing with the brass quintet that maybe might be a new approach to that ensemble?
Sure. As you said, we have these two wonderful premieres. It's unusual for us to have two premieres at one time. But obviously, it's an embarrassment of riches in a certain way. So we're certainly pleased to have that. The first piece for our concert on the 27th is a piece by Kenneth Fuchs. This is a new collaboration for us. Ken is a faculty member at the University of Connecticut, and he's a colleague of our other trumpet player, Lewis Hanslick. They got to speaking about what it would take to write for a brass quintet like ours, and all of a sudden, this piece started to emerge. Ken's writing is very traditional and accessible, but he's really looking for new colors, so that he's using some mutes in a different way. He's looking for colors to sort of blend and trade off in some unusual ways. But he also wants the music to be very audience-friendly, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. And I know maybe some composers might not like to have their music described that way, but I think Ken is really looking for an accessible piece, something that the audience mm-hmm. can sort of get into right away, and that it's also playable. So I think he really, you know, we work with composers all the time when we're having new pieces, and Ken was certainly very eager to see what works and what doesn't, always sending us snippets of different things. So in his particular piece, there's a treatment of a lot of different articulations, a lot of multiple articulations for us all over the place, and some very unusual scale patterns that he's using. So I think it all adds up for a very unique and accessible piece.
Tell us about the other piece then.
Well, so Eric Nathan was a former trumpet player. I actually knew him as a trumpet student at the Juilliard Pre-College, and he's gone on to find bigger and better things through composition. But because of his knowledge of the trumpet, he has a unique ability to write, particularly trumpet parts, but brass in general. So he's written this quintet for us that has a lot of unusual sounds and colors. And he's actually, in the last movement, he has us removing some slides to get some very unusual and colorful sounds going on. So I think the audience is going to be in for a real treat with his piece. It's probably nothing like anybody's ever heard before. And Eric's writing, too, even though it's more unusual than Ken's, Eric's is still very accessible. I don't think anybody's going to be put off by the unusual qualities of the sounds or, you know, what we're doing. I think they're going to be taken in with it because it's very, very interesting, and he's a brilliant, brilliant writer. So I think it should be very exciting.
Tell me about anything that you have on the program that is not Renaissance or contemporary. I know there's that middle period where people weren't writing for brass. It wasn't like string quartet where brass quintets go back.
Right, exactly. So there's very little of that in our total repertoire, and actually we're not doing anything from that period on our recital, but we're going to actually start the recital with a piece by Clint Needham, who's a young composer, a contemporary composer, a piece called Circus. It's an unusual way for us to begin our recitals. Usually we start with early music, and this time we've chosen to start with Circus, which is very raucous and sort of upbeat and very, very uplifting, and it's very programmatic. It's, it really brings to mind all the images of a circus, and he was most scared of the ringleader, so that's the scariest movement that he wrote.
Father figure.
Exactly. Right? But it's a wonderful piece. We've played it a lot. We have it on a recording called Jewels. We thought it's such a well-written piece, and so we wanted to present that first, and then we'll go to some early music. But we don't have anything in the middle period this time.
Do you have arrangements that you've done of pieces that might be familiar.
We get asked that question a lot, and for us in the American Brass Quintet, we don't do arrangements of popular classical pieces or popular jazz pieces or anything like that. So the works that we do really are written either currently for brass quintet or they're five-part music specifically. So even in the early music that you'll hear from the Renaissance, it's just strictly five voices, and we adapt that for the brass. If they're vocal pieces, for example, they may have two soprano parts, alto, tenor, bass, but oftentimes the instrumental parts just are laid out that way, and all we have to do is add some articulations in. So it's very rare that we'll do an arrangement of something where we're changing parts or adding harmonies or something. It's everything that we play on any recital really is actual five-part music.
Is the American Brass Quintet then the first brass quintet, the first major brass quintet to come out, or were brass quintets in existence earlier in the 20th century?
There were many brass quintets that were in existence before the American Brass Quintet, but I would say the real beginning of the brass quintet age started kind of with the New York Brass Quintet. They started in 1952, and the reason I bring them up is because they really wanted to be a serious concertizing brass quintet, and that was really something that was very, very new at the time, and American came along in 1960 with that same mindset, and New York had a different idea about sort of how to approach things, but American really wanted to stay with the idea that they wanted to present serious brass chamber music the whole time. And actually, in fact, at the very beginning, that caused rift in the group. A few members left because they wanted to play more popular things and probably make more money.
Right.
And then the remaining members stayed with it and sort of kept the legacy going. And I have to say, when I entered the group, it was a very special feeling to know that you're continuing a certain tradition that's been going on for so long. And and our newest members, Lewis and Eric, understand that tradition as well, and they're right on board. It's something that we hold very dear, and sometimes that may mean that people don't understand what we do or may not feel like it's very popular what we do, but we do what we do, and hopefully that stands for something.
If you've just joined us, this is Festival Showcase, and we've been talking with a member of the American Brass Quintet. Now let's chat with pianist Jeremy Denk, who has two recitals coming up, one on the 28th and one on the 30th of July.
Tell us a little bit about why you feel such an affinity for Charles Ives. A lot of people either love him or hate him, and I find great joy in his music. In fact, I find myself laughing out loud sometimes almost when I listen to his music.
I first figured out that I liked Ives maybe in college or something like that. There was a certain piece that was played, some of the Concord Sonata, you know, in music history. There's something about Ives' harmonies, you know, they're often very difficult at first, and then they become incredibly beautiful. It's a very unique language, and it reflects something about him, which is that the music is about rediscovering childhood in the past, and the whole world of music from his past, like rejuvenating the whole world of marches and chorales, band, and the whole way that music was a communal experience of catharsis. I guess I also love trying to figure out his pieces, like what are they doing and how do they make sense? And then I, of course, always love at the end when the hymns come out, and after all the complexity, this incredible, he was really great at epiphanies and hard-won revelation.
When you and Stefan are doing all four of the Ives violin sonatas, in between each one of them, there'll be other pieces, many of which I've never heard of before, and I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the pieces in between that you've chosen to link the Ives sonatas to one another.
The Ives sonatas are very romantic pieces, at least within his work. They're very romantic, and they're all very clearly based on very particular hymns and in a very emotional way. Some of these tunes we still know, Yes, Jesus Loves Me, or something like that. But some of the tunes have passed out of our experience, and they need to be footnoted. So you could write in the program note, this movement is based on the hymn Me. But your audience won't particularly know what that hymn is, and they won't experience the amazing way that I have riffs on that hymn unless you hear the hymn next to it. So that's, I think a lot of the pieces in the program are about hearing the stuff that Ives is building the pieces on, and then you hear the piece. There's also something so lovely about, you know, they get up there, the barbershop quartet, and sing to him in this very proper old school way. And then we launch these really dissonant improvs on the gym.
Mm-hmm.
I find it's very moving and wild and very unusual concert experience.
Does he ever make you want to laugh just from the outrageous ways, especially from a man of the early 1900s, to take these hymns and to treat them in the way that he treated them?
Of course. Ives is one of the great musical humorists. And there are many pieces of his that are just jokes or satires or send-ups, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then there are pieces that are deadly, deadly, deadly serious. And mm-hmm. there's all kinds of mixes. As I said, there's a connection for me between sort of Haydn and Beethoven. Beethoven also loved to cross-cut between the sublime and the ridiculous. And he uses it in the Ninth Symphony. He uses it in the famous Hammer Clavier Sonata. There are many famous examples of Beethoven loves this sort of combination of implausibly profound and implausibly ridiculous, and Ives got that from him, at least in part. And, uh-huh. and it was part of his personality, too. He loved, when he was in Yale, he would always do these fraternity musical evenings, musical reviews. So he was really gifted at satire. So, yes, of course, I laugh, and that's one of Ives' best qualities, is he laughs at himself and he laughs at the way we take classical music too seriously.
Right, right. Well, you...
Which is great, which deserves some laughter, too.
And I think it's easier, I think, to hear in Ives than it is in Beethoven, but you touched on something that takes me to your other concert on the 30th of July. In that concert, it seems as though you're trying to weave together things that are in common all the way from the Ars Nova to the 20th or maybe even the 21st century. I wonder if you feel that, like, just like the Jungian archetypes, where Jung felt that there were these universal symbols that you find in all cultures and all religions, that maybe there are musical archetypes too, and that you're finding them, because there's something that I find in your programming that's not just let's hear this piece, now let's hear this piece, now let's hear this piece, but it seems
sure.
as though you're finding things that are in common between composers who you wouldn't think had a lot in common.
I've always loved the sort of story of music history from 1200, Western music history from mm-hmm. 1200 to the best. You know, it's an amazing story of musical thought. And often we forget when we say classical music, we're talking about, you know, almost 1,000 years, really.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it all goes in one section in the record store. And it's an amazing story of the evolution of various languages, the things that are valued, and the way that music feels, the way that time feels when you listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to put together an iPod shuffle of this idea, like to tell the whole story, if possible, through characteristic pieces, and just go, like, seamlessly, and hear, like, a time-lapse photography of the history of music. Does mm-hmm. that make any sense to you? I thought that's the idea.
It does.
So,
when I first heard your concept, I was reminded of a Joseph Campbell book that might show a sculpture from the Incas and then another sculpture from the Catholic Church in the Middle Ages and the similarities or
right.
things like that. And I was just wondering if you were looking for those threads of commonality through the centuries
and through the
cultures.
I am, and that's why the program is particularly hard to put together. It's obviously choosing the pieces that stand in for this whole story. It's really fraught. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what? How do you represent the genius of Mozart in 4 minutes?
Right.
Right? How do you capture it and then move on and keep telling the story so that you hear the connections and you hear the disjunctions too, right? Like, what
mm-hmm.
happened and how did it... And where are we now is sort of the most disturbing question.
Right.
You know, we're somewhere, but is there style anymore? Kundera says that we wandered into some kind of overtime period where all bets are off. There's some anxiety for me about that. Therefore, the story has a certain melancholy. The story of these 1,000 years of music has a little bit of sadness to it. Obviously, there are common threads, and I'm going to try to trace them, but it's also just like the evanescence of all human stylistic consensus and how we keep changing, like, fashion. In the other program I've been playing recently, the point is a little simpler, which is that, you know, there's ragtime, there's jazz, and there's syncopation, and, you know, we think of that kind of syncopation as belonging to this century,
mm-hmm.
but there's rag-like pieces of William Byrd, and there's incredible syncopation in Achigam, and there's unbelievably complicated rhythmic stuff that happens throughout. And there's even, you know, wonderful Beethoven pieces that sound like ragtime, and there's a Mozart jig that sounds like arcade. I mean, you know, and so it's like tracing that through music
mm-hmm.
history, if possible, here,
right.
and how it keeps coming back. And and the ways the composers use syncopation to enliven the square and take something staid and make it alive and new and witty. And so that's what that part of that program, this program I've been playing this year, is all about. That's also a music historical grab bag, but it has a more specific theme.
Do you feel that, since you're a very talented writer, you wrote the libretto for classical style and even encouraged a major composer to set it to music, you're writing books, you have your blog. I wonder if your writing ability gives you sort of a sense of a narration in your performance as well, that in a sense you're speaking to an audience, almost using your language skills somehow through your fingers.
Language tries to borrow some great qualities of music, and music often tries to borrow some great qualities of language. They are often very happy collaborators. They aren't opposed. They're not enemies. So Beethoven often, like, for example, or, you know, high classical period, has such a narrative ethos. It sounds like a novel being constructed, you know, a plot. Yeah, I do feel there's all kinds of great things to draw from storytelling when you're performing a musical work.
We've been talking with pianist Jeremy Denk about his upcoming concerts on July 28th and July 30th. We're going to talk now with violinist Adele Anthony. Adele, this week you have two major 20th century composers, Prokofiev and Martinu, that you'll be performing. Why don't we start by talking a little bit about the Prokofiev First Violin Concerto? I'm guessing that is not an easy piece to get under your belt.
Well, it's one of my favorite concertos to listen to and to even to practice. It's just such a well-written piece of music, and I think the word that really comes to mind is magical with it, because it has these flourishes and a beautiful orchestration, and he uses the technique of the violin so well that it's really just for effect. You don't really think about, you know, how hard it is or, you know, the difficulties of it. It just has these effects that you don't really hear in any other concerto.
Now, I know when Prokofiev wrote piano music, he wanted to treat the piano as a percussion instrument, very strong rhythmic elements. Can you say a little bit about how the rhythmic elements work in a piece like this, where the soloist is a string player?
Well, I think this piece has a lot of Prokofiev's facets to it. It's very lyrical in the first place, and then there is a kind of motor, kind of the machinist aspect to it. You know, there's a very rhythmic accompaniment in the orchestra, and there are some percussive elements in the violin, pizzicato and things he uses in those effects, but you can definitely hear the clock ticking or the motor running as the piece goes on.
Right. Now, this is going to be taking place on Wednesday the 27th with the Aspen Philharmonic Orchestra. Then you're sticking around for Saturday to do a Martinu piece that I don't think very many of us have ever heard.
Right, I'm playing the Martinu duo for violin and cello, duo number one, and I'm playing it with my very, very good friend and wonderful cellist, Brinton Smith. And we go back a long way. We were students at Juilliard together and have played a lot of duos together, but hadn't actually played this one. So we've been trying to put it together for many, many years, and we're so happy to finally arrive at this point.
And if people don't know Martinu, can you tell us a little bit about him as a composer? Because people don't realize what a gem he is.
He was a Czech composer, and he wrote a lot of small chamber works that a lot of us play, the trio and the sextet. I don't know, so it's very melodic and very bohemian, the music.
You come up here every summer. Your husband, Gil Shaham, is with you. It seems like the conductor, David Robertson, who's married to Gil's sister Orly, who's a phenomenal pianist. So here are four very talented performers with international careers, and you all get to come up to Aspen. Is this one of your favorite times where you just get to be with extended family and get to just enjoy the beauty of Aspen for a while?
Oh, definitely. Our family looks forward to this every year, and our kids talk about it all year long until we actually arrive. And we, you know, it's such a privilege to be around so many fantastic musicians. We always enjoy the playing here and the performing, as well as the atmosphere of the city.
There are a lot of recordings that are out among the four of you, but I want to talk and focus on recordings that you have put out. You've done Philip Glass. You've done, is it Franz Schubert, I think?
Yes, Schubert,
I'm remembering correctly.
Yes.
And then isn't there some CD out that's called Music to Die For or something that you're on? Or I don't
know. Oh, yes.
The Naxos record?
Yeah, that's a compilation. But I think on there is some of the Ross Edwards, which is an Australian composer. He wrote a violin mm-hmm. concerto called Maninas, mm-hmm. and also Sibelius Concerto, which I recorded.
Now, you started the Sibelius very young, weren't you, like 13 or something,
yes,
when you played with
right.
Queensland Orchestra?
Yes.
Right, wow. Now, was that a youth concert, like you won the prize, which included a chance to play this on
right,
the program?
Right, that's right. I won in Australia, it was called the Instrumental and Vocal Competition at the time. Mm-hmm. So it was a national competition, and I was fortunate enough to win playing Sibelius Concerto, which obviously is a concerto that's very near and dear to me.
Now, you started at, what, 2.5 or something, at some age where you must have had some kind of micro-violin to play in.
Yeah, I began when I was 2.5. We lived in Tasmania, which is a small island state at the bottom of Australia.
Right.
Very isolated, and I think I was in the first Suzuki group that was begun there in Hobart. And it was my father was a violinist mm-hmm. in the Tasmanian Symphony at the time, and his colleague was beginning this Suzuki group and said, would Adele be interested? And at that time, I was, 18 months or so. And my father thought, oh no, she's much too young. And I was showing interest. I was following my father around while he practiced and with a mm-hmm. brush and comb and imitating him.
Oh, wow.
So he said, well, just bring her along. And if, it doesn't take off, that's fine. So, mm-hmm. and I stuck with it ever since. So I think I enjoyed violin.
Now, you said you're not teaching privately here, but I know you have interaction with students here at the Aspen Music Festival and School, which is true of both you and Gil. You both came up through the Aspen Music Festival
That's
as
right.
well. So tell me a little bit. On the Wednesday, you've got an all-student orchestra that you're playing with, but it's not your average student orchestra, is it?
Right. That's the unique aspect of Aspen. You get to perform with these student orchestras, but they're of such a high standard. It's mm-hmm. not your run-of-the-mill student orchestra. So you have these great musicians, but with this eagerness to learn the music and to perform. And I think Prokofiev is especially a colorful piece and great for playing with a student orchestra that has a harp part and percussion and tuba. It's very colorful, well mm-hmm. written for mm-hmm. them. Yeah.
Now, you've got a lot of really talented string players here in Aspen, the students. I mean, I always wonder, for any musician who's up there in recital or in your case mm-hmm. soloing with the orchestra, do you ever worry that they look at you and go, oh, I could do that better? Or
that's a thing that, when you play with a professional orchestra, you don't have people coming to you saying, well, I'm studying that concerto too.
Right.
But, you know that a lot of the kids are probably studying the same piece that you are, and they know every single note just as well. So it keeps you on your toes.
I would imagine. Yeah. You can't fool them, can you?
That's right.
We've been chatting with violinist Adele Anthony, who puts on a performance of Prokofiev's Violin Concerto No. 1 along with the Aspen Philharmonic Orchestra tomorrow, Wednesday, July 27th. In addition, she plays a Martinu duo on Saturday, July 30th. Finally, let's chat with two young members of the Aspen Contemporary Ensemble. Their next concert is part of the Saturday Afternoon Chamber series at 4:30. Here's clarinetist Juan Gabriel Oliveras and percussionist Hannah Weaver. There are audience members who are afraid of contemporary music. They've been burned. It's like a bad romance or something, and they don't want to get back out there. So for people like that who might be willing to give it a try, what advice might you have for people who might be listening to this music and are at least willing to give it another try, thinking, well, I hear that 21st century music is not quite the same as late 20th century, that kind of thing. Do you have any thoughts about what kinds of ears and minds and hearts people can bring to the concerts you'd ideally like to hear?
Well, I think it's interesting that you ask that question, because I have such a intimate relationship with being a performer and an audience member.
Mm-hmm.
I love going to concerts. Last night I went to go see Simone Dinderstein play the Bach Goldberg Variations. And then uh-huh. the night before I went and I saw Midori do some solo violin partitas by also J.S. Bach. And I have this particular attitude every time I go into a concert where mm-hmm. I want to hear what somebody as a musician has to say on their instrument, regardless of the music.
Mm-hmm.
It's so much more about watching them express themselves. Obviously, some musicians have a better choice in the repertoire that they get to perform. But when it comes to contemporary music, I think the only piece of advice I would ever give to anybody, whether it's a student or a friend or a colleague, is to always, always be open to experiencing just a completely different sound and a different experience.
Sure. Yeah, I think you definitely need to approach music like this with an open mind. And I think better communication from performers and from composers can really benefit that. I think that's true in most genres of music now. A lot of classical groups are struggling with decreasing attendance and are trying to find ways to reach out to audiences and find new ways to engage audience members and bring in new blood. And I think that having that kind of communication and that outreach in contemporary music also is really important. And I think that's kind of wonderful at most of the concerts that I've been to here at Aspen, either by reading program notes or by hearing short pre-concert talks by performers. It really makes for a more engaging and satisfying performance.
Do either of you have some experience with talking to audiences before a piece gets performed?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think it's extremely important, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I think what you probably experienced yesterday at the Chapel concert was our own conductor, Donald Crockett, giving just a small pre-talk about the Timo Andres piece that we just did. And the fact that he was sharing these little tiny anecdotes about, you know, the connection between Beethoven and Timo Andres.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the idea of the chaconne and how that mm-hmm. can kind of move throughout all different kinds of music. And in general, the chaconne has been known as a harmonic progression that repeats. But in this case, it actually felt more that the percussion was the chaconne. And I thought that was amazing for Don to bring out because it had mm-hmm. everybody engage on a different level. So definitely talking before a concert is extremely important. And I recommend every single musician to do it.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. And as uncomfortable as it is sometimes for people, it makes such a difference for the audience member. Because the thing that I think sometimes we forget as performers is that we've often been living with these pieces, and mm-hmm. they're very close to us, and they're very integrated in our person and our performance. But the audience member is getting this one taste of it, and the difference between real time and the temporal time of being in the piece, I don't think you can always gain as much from the performance when you're just hearing it once, if you don't have those few key points to kind of latch onto and connect
Absolutely.
With.
And I find sometimes as a listener that we all, I think, as most audience members, have an instinct to listen for melody and harmony. But that may not be the essence of what a piece is about. If it's about something rhythmic or textural or something like that, and somebody says, just listen to the amazing sounds and textures that are happening here, it gets the brain out of the old way of thinking, I guess
sure.
you might say, or the habits of thinking.
I also think that one of the great things about live performance is getting to see somebody's personality.
Mm-hmm.
You could have 100 different violinists play the same piece, and you're always going to get something different.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we live for as performers, is getting to know everybody's personality through their instruments, through the music that they make themselves.
And I will say that the piece I just heard you play got not only warm applause, but you were called out for a second bow. And this doesn't always happen with contemporary music, but when it does happen, it must be very rewarding, because this was not a piece that pandered to the audience, but it was a piece that the audience obviously felt connected to.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming in. I'll just tell you that Hannah and Juan came in at 8 a.m. to do this interview a few days ago, and that's not an easy thing for most performing musicians. So thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having
me. Thank you.
This has been Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the music and the artists behind the 2016 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. Please join me Tuesdays at 3:30 or the rebroadcast Saturdays at 3 for more interviews. My name is Chris Moore. Thank you for listening.